I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to continue our ongoing conversation about community and public health. Supported by reporting from Side Effects, we're going to take a look at the impact of retail access to tobacco in Indianapolis. My guests are Karen Fredrickson-Comer, Director of Collaborative Research and Health Geoinformatics at the Polis Center, Claire Fidian-Green, President and CEO of the Fairbanks Foundation, and Dr. Virginia Kane, Director of the Marion County Public Health Department. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits at wfyi.org, Facebook is No Limits WFYI, Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about some new research that reveals information about the impact of access to retail tobacco in the Metro Indy area and what it means for the health of Central Indiana residents. This show is in conjunction with the reporting done by the Side Effects Health Reporting Team. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Karen Fredrickson-Comer. She is Director of Collaborative Research and Health Geoinformatics at the Polis Center. Good luck getting all of that on a business card. Claire Fidian-Green, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Fairbanks Foundation. And Dr. returning for, what, is this the fourth or fifth time? Dr. Virginia Kane, Director of the Marion County Public Health Department. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you for having us.
It's good to have you here. And I should do, in the interest of full disclosure, acknowledge the fact that WFYI and Side Effects receive financial support from the Fairbanks Foundation. This is an important conversation, and probably to set the stage, we need a little bit of background, and fortunately we have a piece that does that. While the smoking rate has declined overall in the United States, it remains high among the poor. New research in Indianapolis shows in certain low-income neighborhoods, people smoke at a rate 2 times the national average. Side Effects public media reporter Emily Foreman took a walk with the researcher to find out why.
I met Kelly Davila in her neighborhood to see how many tobacco retailers we can spot on a 1 mile walk.
We are on the Near East Side of Indianapolis on 10th Street at a dollar store.
Davila co-authored a new report on tobacco retail for the Polis Center at IUPUI. This stretch of 10th Street is what public health experts refer to as a tobacco swamp, a place where there are dense clusters of stores that sell cigarettes.
Okay, so let's see how long it takes to walk from the Family Dollar to the next location.
Okay. Davila times us.
Are we rolling?
Yep.
Okay. Her research found that where there are many stores short walking distances apart, there are a lot of smokers. In fact, 1 in 3 people smoke in what Davila calls a high access area. That's 2 times the national average. Whereas the smoking rate is much lower in Fishers, for example, where there are fewer retailers.
So we can see that there is a link between these two things, between smoking and access to retailers.
Additionally, in these areas, poverty is higher. There are fewer households with a vehicle, more people of color, more moms who smoke.
So we're already at the next one.
We reach a gas station convenience store.
It's been 2 minutes.
And then 6 minutes later.
So this is another one, but this is a bar.
2 minutes.
Oh, there we go. It's another gas station.
Okay, so high tobacco density equates to higher smoking rates. Makes sense. But how did these neighborhoods get this way? To find out, I called Dr. Joseph Lee, an assistant professor of health promotion at East Carolina University.
Hello again.
He studied this nationally and found the same patterns. Low-income neighborhoods have more tobacco retailers than others.
My take is that there are two things going on.
One is store density, and the other is the amount of marketing dollars tobacco companies spend to target these neighborhoods. Lee has also researched tobacco marketing.
And we found some really clear and compelling patterns that neighborhoods with fewer resources, less money, had more marketing of tobacco products, and neighborhoods with more African-American residents had more tobacco products.
And he says if you were to read through thousands of publicly available documents from court cases involving tobacco companies, it's evident they profile communities. But the retail store landscape predates those marketing strategies.
So if you think about going back to bank redlining when it was harder to get loans within neighborhoods with more African-American residents, then there would have been fewer resources in those communities.
That means you end up with a lot of really small family-owned convenience stores that don't have a whole lot of products, but they do have a lot of tobacco marketing.
Got two liquor stores and one gas station. It's about 2 minutes away from the last place.
So in total, on less than a mile of road, in about 15 minutes, we counted 7 stores.
Hey, what's up?
Who are you guys?
A guy named Phil walks up with his girlfriend, Deborah.
Maybe one day I quit, just cold turkey again. You know, and start back exercising like I used to, get in the gym.
Phil says he buys a pack of Newports at the Speedway or the Marathon whenever he's out.
Sometimes you might get a coupon in the mail.
$2 off.
It depends.
$2 off 2 packs. Or buy one, get one 50% off.
Coupons. That's a tool the tobacco industry uses to keep customers in select communities. In 2014, the industry spent almost 2/3 of its $5 billion marketing budget on discounts like this. In some states, like Rhode Island, local governments have managed to ban these discounts. But Indiana passed a law 20 years ago that restricts localities from regulating tobacco retail sales and marketing. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Emily Foreman.
That was Emily Foreman from Side Effects reporting, giving us an overview, really, on the challenges before us. We're going to be talking today on No Limits about, really, the impact of access to retail tobacco on community and public health here in Indianapolis. I guess I'm going to ask a question that springs out of that, and I'd like everybody's answer on this. Is it a chicken and egg kind of question here? Are those stores there and selling tobacco because that's where the market is, or are people buying the tobacco simply because it is more readily available there? I'll start with you on that one, Karen.
Well, our study doesn't look at causation, so we can't really speak to which comes first. But I think the main point is that we've got the situation where we've got these vulnerable populations with more exposure to health, to the tobacco. So that's really the focus of our concern.
Is there, Dr. Kane, do you have any thoughts on the causation of this? Why? Because it's a large, you know, part of what we're revealing here also is Indianapolis has a problem that other parts of the country don't have right now. So we got to ask why. Can't really solve the problem unless you know why it exists. So we've got to dive into that. But do we know why these areas in particular seem to be prone to these behaviors?
Well, I know that at one point, Indianapolis was the number one market for young teenagers for cigarettes in the country.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say that we have a significant area of low vulnerable populations in our area, and our poverty has probably tripled since 2007. Or not triple, but double since 2007. So when that happens, you have populations that are a little bit more stressed from an environmental mm-hmm. standpoint, challenge. The anxiety may go up. So as teenagers, they're way more vulnerable mm-hmm. to initiating cigarette smoking than, say, someone who's got great resources out in the suburb, and I'm not saying like a tobacco outlet easily accessible. Because, see, marketing is the key.
Mm-hmm.
And so whether you go to a convenience store, you have prominent displays of the tobacco, you know, as you're buying, whatever you're buying, your products, very colorful. And especially with electronic cigarettes, these kids are really vulnerable. So health literacy, how well do those communities, what is their health literacy level? So if they've had difficulties in terms of accessing health care, they don't get the education and promotion targeted to them as much.
Claire.
And I would just add that while the report doesn't focus on correlation, we do have a lot of data
about just how much exposure there is to advertising. The data show that today's average 15-year-old has been exposed to $20 billion of tobacco advertising from the age of six. And that's a pretty powerful force to have to counteract. And then if you just look at the data from the CDC, it shows that in Indiana, in households with less than $15,000 in annual income, the smoking rate is over 35%. And that drops significantly when incomes go above $50,000. The rate drops to about 11.7%. So there's clearly a connection between your income level and the smoking rates in Indiana.
Yeah, I think the Washington Post probably had the best headline on that, where they said the rich have stopped smoking, but the poor have continued. You really didn't need to read the story after that because of the headline told it all. Do we have any idea, though, why that is?
Well, I think when you have a lot of challenges, you may have a tendency to self-medicate yourself. Mm-hmm. And we know in Marion County, from a mental health standpoint, especially our youngsters, teenagers and young adults, our young males, 18 to 25-year-olds, stated in the last 30 days, greater than 15 of those days was associated with poor mental health. They weren't feeling great. So they are trying to self-medicate themselves. So sometimes people smoke to try to calm their nerves, or it reduces their anxiety per se.
But presumably, Claire, and I'll throw this one to you, presumably Indianapolis and Indiana aren't the only places in the earth that tobacco companies are targeting with their marketing. Why do we seem to be more receptive to it than other places? And we're not the only place in the world that has poverty either. So why is it that it's taken more of a root here?
That's correct. Well, interestingly, we just had the panel session this morning on WFY with Savvy Talks on this on this topic, and it was Dean Paul Halverson at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health and Brian Mills who were mentioning the fact that we have one of the lower rates of taxes on cigarettes. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the rest of the country where there are much lower rates of adult smoking, they have much higher taxes on cigarettes. So that is a well-researched, evidence-based policy intervention that serves as a barrier, especially for people with less income, mm-hmm. to purchase costly tobacco products and then get hooked and become lifelong addicts.
So some of it is that the government intervention, we haven't set up a barrier, we haven't created disincentives, government-supported disincentives to discourage people from smoking. Are there any other reasons? Go ahead, Dr. King.
I think we're trying to get at is that, one, the funding is not there for public health, you know, the prevention arm. So if you have less resources, the tobacco company spent $380 million in the state of Indiana to do marketing for cigarettes. We have $7 million. So you compare to $7 million to $385 million. So that's the first thing. So what's the mindset of the folks here in Indiana who I think are not doing as good a job as they could to protect the young children here.
Karen, do you have numbers on other states that have had more success in curtailing particularly young smoking and smoking among those who are less than affluent? What are the approaches that work?
Well, I know some other states are doing things like regulating sales prices. They're regulating where the tobacco outlets can be located. So there are some other states that are doing work in the to lessen the point-of-sale exposure of their citizens to tobacco.
What are some of those states?
So Florida has a great state that they've had a campaign for adolescents, but they spent the money on the campaign, and the messaging was specifically targeted to that age group and a lot of peers. The other thing has to do with, I think Claire just stated, that we're not even at the national average of our cigarette tax cost and price. So we're in the bottom 15, I believe, as a state. And so a lot of interventions that would have some impact. We can't change that. We have not been able yet to change the mindset of our policymakers to go that additional step.
And we are going to talk, obviously, about the gas tax. We're coming up on a break, and I know that's a little bit of a deeper dive than we can do in, I think, 15 or 20 seconds. But Florida is one of the places. Florida and Indiana have very different kinds of parallels or profiles. Are there any states in the Midwest or states that are in some way similar to Indiana that have had success?
Minneapolis is a city.
Minnesota?
Yes. Yeah.
So
the interesting thing is Kentucky has better smoking rates than we do, and even North Carolina, and they're in the top five in terms of growing tobacco and yet
production. Yeah.
They do a much better job with their smoking rates, North Carolina and Kentucky, and yet we rank eighth growing tobacco in the country.
We are talking about the impact of access to retail tobacco on community and public health on No Limits. My guests are Karen Fredrickson-Comer, Director of Collaborative Research and Health Geoinformatics at the Polis Center, Claire Fidian-Green of the Fairbanks Foundation, and Dr. Virginia Kane of the Marion County Public Health Department. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking today about what some new research reveals about the impact of access to retail tobacco in Indianapolis, particularly in the metro Indy area, and how that affects community and public health. My guests are Karen Fredrickson-Comer. She's director of collaborative research and health geoinformatics at the Polis Center. Claire Fidian-Green, she's president and CEO of the Fairbanks Foundation, and Dr. Virginia Kane, director of the Marion County Public Health Department. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Ron has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Ron, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John, once again for taking my call.
Certainly.
And, here we go.
Okay.
I've been a smoker for over 50 years. For the last 17 years, I've smoked a cigarette by a manufacturer called Natural American Spirits, which is the only manufacturer in the United States that does not add chemicals to their tobacco. I would think on a health concern basis, the people in power would go after those manufacturers which add known cancer-causing chemicals to their tobacco. I would compare my health to men half my age, women half my age. I think a bigger problem is probably obesity than smoking, and nothing is being done about that, so I'd like to say leave my cigarettes alone. Smokers in history have been Winston Churchill, Kurt Vonnegut, Barack Obama, and it didn't harm them from doing their duties. I entered into skilled trades at the age of 55, which required going to college and studying and getting my lessons done. And I was a smoker while I was doing that. It didn't change my behavior at all or my mental acuity. And I've noticed in my employment of skilled tradespeople, the best tradesmen, and I can tell you this because I see it on a daily basis and I can find people who agree with it, the best people who are tradesmen are smokers. I think I got it all out.
Okay, there's a fair bit for us to unpack there. So thanks very much for the call and for sharing your thoughts, Ron. Take care.
Thank you, John.
Certainly. So
we don't respond to him. We just let him make his comments.
No, you can respond to him. The show's called No Limits for a reason.
Okay. You get to, you've been a very extraordinary young gentleman, and you probably got great genes in your family, but when our smoking rates were really high, our SIDS deaths were increasing. We had a lot of babies dying. Our kids with pediatric asthma was the number one hospitalization at Riley Hospital because of smoking. Smoking contributes to heart attacks. We've got lung cancer to 20% higher than the national average. So smoking really impacts a lot of people and it doesn't kill everybody, but it can negatively impact folks. And you're an adult, so you can make your own decisions. I'm here trying to protect the young children and adolescents. You know, I wouldn't let a little 5-year-old toddler cross the street when there's traffic going down that street without me taking their hand and monitoring and watching them. So that's the same with this. You know, until I feel that person has got the knowledge, I'm going to try to protect those children, those babies.
And
Go ahead, Claire.
I would just add, John, that tobacco is actually the leading cause of death and preventable disease in Indiana and the rest of the United States. So in Indiana alone, we have more than 11,000 Hoosiers who die every year because of tobacco-related diseases. So if you think about the number of people, then they give you some imagery here over the radio. That's like having two fatal 747 airplane crashes every month. Mm-hmm. That's what that equates to. And we hear so much about the opioid epidemic, which is terrible. But in terms of the number of people who are dying from opioids right now, the latest data we have show that people die at 10 times the rate from tobacco than they do from drug overdoses in Indiana. So it is the leading cause of preventable death and disease. The other thing is that it has a significant economic impact on every Hoosier, regardless of whether or not you smoke. So for every pack of cigarettes sold, the cost borne is $15.90 in health care costs and lost productivity. It has a very significant impact both economically and in terms of lives lost.
And I'm going to try to say this in a way that is not disparaging to either side. But this argument at some level, I've heard Ron's argument before. I've heard the counter arguments before. So there's a certain kind of circularity to this, which I think, again, takes me back to this why question. I mean, it's clear, if you listen to Ron, that smoking is more than just a way to pass the time for him or something like that. And he sees, he sees this as a question of personal autonomy, mm-hmm. and his right. And there are a lot of people out there. I mean, you know, you hear that term smoker's rights and all of that. How do you deal with or alter that mindset? I was going to use the word combat, but I'm going to try to get us out of the adversarial posture here and move us more toward a point where we can talk about this in ways that don't put people's guards up right away. I'll start with you, Dr. Kane, but then I want to hear Karen's thoughts, too.
I do want to compliment him because he's very smart. Mm-hmm. He's done his homework on one level, and that is we know that most of the cigarette brands are cut with products that are carcinogens, formaldehyde, mm-hmm. and a lot of chemicals, and that's what creates the antigen for causing lung cancer. So if his cigarette brand is natural, like he says, and is strictly just nicotine, that's really huge and probably why he's having such a good outcome related to that. But despite that, I feel I do have to protect the children. I feel that I have to get the information out there about what the consequences can be associated with this so that people are making informed decisions.
Karen.
Well, I just wanted to say that we know that over 70% of Hoosier smokers report wanting to quit, but studies have shown that living in areas with a high concentration of tobacco outlet means it's easier to start smoking and a lot harder to quit. So our goal in doing this research was to inform or create awareness around this issue and provide the community with actionable evidence.
Gotten an email from our regular listener, Jerry, and again, if you want to join this conversation by email, you can send your comment or question to nolimits@wfyi.org. Jerry writes, do any of the panelists know why people who claim to believe in federalism, that is, defending states' rights from federal challenge, so zealously assert the rights of states to overrule the interests of local communities in matters of public health? Basically, why we can't have home rule when it comes to smoking policies and all of that. Karen's making the mistake of smiling at me at the wrong moment, so I'm going to throw that
thank
to
God
her.
She smiled at you.
So I'm going to throw the question to her first.
Well, you may have to repeat that.
Okay, well, what he really wants to know is why can't local communities here in Indiana make up their own rules in regard to smoking policy? Why does the legislature have...
Well, in 1997, preemptive law was put into a place that prevents local communities from putting in more stringent controls than the state. And that, what my understanding from other experts in this field is that the tobacco lobbyists just did a really good job in getting that through locally.
How much of this is, I mean, the numbers that Dr. Kane cited, that the tobacco industry spends more than $380 million marketing here.
I'm sorry. No, I apologize. It should have been $285
million. $285
million. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And we spend about $7
million. We spend $7
million. But having covered politics and particularly state government here in Indiana for a long time, I can estimate that the chances that you know, the Indiana General Assembly would ever come up with $285 million to combat smoking in Indiana are less than zero.
So that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. But CDC recommends a minimum amount of funding that they think will make a huge difference in the state of Indiana.
What is that minimum?
That is $73 million.
So we're looking at a tenfold increase.
Yes, so we're at $7 million. We're less than 10% of where we need to get at.
So let me ask this then, Claire, since you're here with the fund. I mean, you know, if the state government won't do it, would the philanthropic community be able to match that? Or is that a too big a lift even for you know, a place where we've got not just the Fairbanks, which is a large foundation, but the Lilly Endowment, a lot of other major funders?
I think the recommendations from CDC are for public dollars, for federal and state dollars. Those are dollars that they recommend states spend on proven programs like helping people quit, because tobacco is addictive. You have an addiction. You just heard the statistics about 70% of people wanting to quit and struggling to do so. The good news is there actually are proven programs. We have the 1-800-QUIT-NOW line here in Indiana that is funded with state dollars. There are also proven messaging and communications campaigns to help connect people with services to help them quit. And then there are also proven medications that can help people quit, too. So there actually are a lot of resources available to help people. And the additional funding that the CDC recommends really goes to all of those things. It's communications, it's awareness, it's education, and then it's connecting people with services to help them quit successfully.
We have got a tweet from a listener named Bruce, and if you want to reach out to us on Twitter, you can find us at No Limits. Bruce writes, "One thing is for sure, when you combine marketing and the audience, adults 25 to 49 smoke at high rate with lower education, blue collar. The problem with substance abuse is not just tobacco. The same audience profile is deep in the opioid epidemic. Answer, anti-marketing." Karen?
Yes, I think that counter-marketing is a known action or intervention for tobacco smoking. And I think one of the things that our report helps is thinking about which areas would be good places to target counter-marketing, such as on billboards or on buses.
We're talking about really what the impact on community and public health of access to retail tobacco is here in Indianapolis and in central Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what a listener named Tim has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Tim, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks. Great show. I love everything everybody's talking about. I like the one you've been in the beginning, what you did, the interview in the hood, because I'm a person that's been in the suburbs. Now I'm in the hood. So I see both sides. So I notice that when you're, what's it called, demographics? When your demographics change, the things that go on when it's a poor neighborhood don't go on when it becomes more progressive, or what you call them people, hipsters. I think that's what young folk call now. When they move in and economics change, the same variances and ordinances change, because the people there who have more money can change and veto. But when you're poor, nobody's standing up for you. nobody's this or that, and everybody's got stress. And you're right. You go, I have a special needs child. If it wasn't for him, I'd probably be on heroin or whatever, But the small part about that is people don't go to extreme. They go to cigarettes. It's a slower poison. But I can't do that in front of my son because he's already got enough problems with autism, and he follows people. So I say all that to say, when the neighborhood changed, why is it that the demographics changed? If you change the ordinances now, why should you have to wait till people have money to do things like that? Why you allow it now? It's allowed. I live in Fountain Square. The demographics are changing drastically. They don't allow certain things in certain parts of the street. The closer you get to Fountain Square, the better regulations are, the less congested with people selling cigarettes and liquor. There's new ordinances. When you live in the poor, you can have more. I think that contributes, and it takes it. I ain't never been to college. I ain't never had no marketing degree, but I can see that. You're poor, market them.
Tim, thanks very much for the call. I'm going to toss that one to Dr. Kane first. Thank you.
So here's the thing. When you're out in the suburbs or economically things change, those folks got money. They have the resources to do more influence on their policymakers. And they say, hey, I don't want this in my neighborhood. When you're in the other neighborhoods where the poverty is maybe three times mm-hmm. what you see in the suburb, hey, you can't even get a grocery store. You know, in places, you know, we got these food deserts in those low-income places. But you don't always, you're so stressed, you don't always have the resources and the time to go down there and argue about, I don't want this happening in my neighborhoods. But I'm telling you, it's changing now. Folks are saying, enough's enough. I got to protect my children.
And how much of this, because I know we're focusing on the community and public health piece of this, but there are economic impacts as well and personal economic ones in that there can be kind of a spiraling effect here. You, Dr. Kane, well, all three of you alluded to the fact that anxiety kind of produces often about poverty or distressed circumstances. But smoking's not an inexpensive habit. So it contributes to, it takes the money away from the household that to sustain it, which adds to the anxiety, that which then fuels even more the need or the perceived need to smoke. Is this kind of a, well,
so
Dr. Cannon.
So let me just say, this report is powerful. Our last caller innately realized that this was going on. You know, and we've felt that this has been going on, but this is the first time we've got a study, evidence proof, to show no doubt that we have all these retail outlets in high concentrations in our poor neighborhoods. And so clear evidence that if we can get this information out to the neighborhoods, they now know it's not what I think or what I imagine. I know for a fact this is happening to our neighborhoods. So this is a very powerful piece.
And I'm sorry, but I'm paid to be somewhat skeptical here. You know, we have been focused on dealing with the consequences of smoking ever since the first Surgeon General's report more than a half a century ago. Mm-hmm. And the response has always been more public education will be the magic bullet. It's reduced it, but it hasn't eliminated the problem, Karen.
Well, over the past 50 years, smoking rates have fallen dramatically, but among the poor and minority populations, it's fallen much less. So there is something going on here. I mean, population health disparities are not random. So I think looking at the associated social and environmental determinants, kind of what we've been talking about today, I think is a valuable exercise.
Claire.
Well, I would just add, too, that you're right that smoking has been a problem for many years. There has been a dramatic decline nationally, 50% to now 15%. But here in Indiana, we're 20.6% is our average adult smoking rate. And then, as I said earlier, it's much higher in households with lower income. So I think it's very clear that public education and outreach is important, critical to help connect people who are addicted to tobacco to services to help them quit. But that's not enough. You need to also have in place evidence-based policies that will help people stop smoking or never start in the first place.
We're talking about the impact of smoking on community and public health on No Limits. My guests are Karen Fredrickson-Comer, Claire Fidian-Green, and Dr. Virginia Kane. I am John Krall. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the impact, continuing our conversation, really, community conversation, about the impact of smoking and the access to retail tobacco in Indianapolis, how it affects the health of central Indiana citizens. This obviously is done in conjunction with WFYI's Side Effects Health Reporting Team. My guests are Karen Fredrickson-Comer. She is Director of Collaborative Research and Health Geoinformatics at the Polis Center. Claire Fidian-Green, she is President and CEO of the Fairbanks Foundation, and Dr. Virginia Kane, Director of the Marion County Health Public Health Department. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Ken has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Ken, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to touch on something that one of your previous colleagues had said about the people that he worked with that were smokers were often much harder workers than those that didn't, and also something about some health problems. My father smoked all his life, and he was a very hard worker, and he worked hard all his life. Unfortunately, he ended up dying at age 43 from esophageal cancer that had spread to his lungs. And my mother also smoked both before and during her pregnancy with me and thereafter. And I was born 2 months premature and have had several health problems my entire life. I'm 37 now, and I have asthma, and I've never smoked during my entire life. And I have some other medical problems that have come from my birth. And I'm a direct result from things from smoking, and I never smoked any in my life. So,
thanks very much for the call and for sharing your story, Ken.
Thank you.
Certainly. We've gotten a couple of emails also that are similar to that, so I think we can do, because it's really about that kind of distributive effect that, yes, you know, you may not experience as horrible, or you may be willing to accept the horrible consequences of smoking yourself, but it does affect other people around
you. It's Russian roulette.
Mm-hmm. Really? Yeah. Yeah, we've got one from a listener named Ruth who wants to know what it will take to have smoking banned in multifamily units. Costs nothing to implement. And then one from a listener named Matt who wants us to address the environmental impact of smokers littering. Most smokers have no respect for water quality from littering into the roadside drains of the thousands of tons of litter it creates elsewhere. So we probably ought to talk a little bit, because we focused on what it does to the individual who smokes. We talk a little bit about what it does to the people in the community around those people who smoke. Claire, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I mentioned earlier that 11,000 Hoosiers die every year because of tobacco. There's also another 1,400 who die every year because of exposure to secondhand smoke. So we have very clear and compelling evidence that even if you yourself are not a smoker, the fact that other people around you are smoking has a negative impact upon your health. It certainly impacts all of our pocketbooks. I mentioned earlier that the almost 80% of us in Indiana who don't smoke nonetheless bear the burden with both our federal and state taxes. In fact, there was a study that the Fairbanks Foundation commissioned and released earlier this year that showed for the last most recent fiscal year ending June 2016, Hoosiers on Medicaid who smoke cost the state of Indiana $540 million more than Hoosiers on Medicaid who do not smoke. That was just for 1 year. So it's really clear that there's a significant impact on all of us, whether or not we smoke.
Got an email from a listener named Caleb. And our email address, if you want to join the conversation via email, is nolimits@wfyi.org. Caleb writes, I am a 26-year-old male from southern Indiana. I have been smoking for almost 10 years. I'm glad for the researchers and the effort to limit access to tobacco. Like the statistic mentioned, I would love to quit smoking. I have tried several times. My access to cigarettes is easily the biggest factor in my continued smoking. I have lamented how easy it is for me to get a pack of cigarettes countless times. If my access to tobacco was more limited, I strongly feel my attempts to quit may have ended in success. Does the research support that, Karen?
Well, the research supports that there is disparate access to tobacco. I think what we wanted to do was to see whether or not what our tobacco environment looked like in Indianapolis, and see whether or not we've got some of the similar issues as other cities. And with that information, we want to create awareness around the issue of tobacco access, so that we can empower the community to take action.
We are talking about the impact of smoking on community and public health here in Indianapolis. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Thomas has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Thomas, welcome to the program.
Sorry about that. Thank you for having me. I'm an emergency room physician here in Indianapolis. I actually travel in from other states, one of them being New York, where the cost of cigarettes is $10, $10.50 a pack. And
wow.
New York has and California is 11, and has a significantly lower rate of smokers. So, you know, it's already been discussed. The research bears out that as you raise the price of cigarettes, you know, smoking goes down. And then I just want to address what a couple of people have talked about is the cancer, esophageal, lung cancer, bladder cancer, colon cancer rates, all increased by smoking. But that's actually not the problem, or not nearly as much of the problem as the vascular damage. So 100% of smokers get vascular damage. They're going to have heart attacks at a much younger age. They're going to have strokes at a much younger age. They're going to have erectile dysfunction at a much younger age. So the cancer is a problem for sure. And this is to go back to your first caller that said his natural cigarettes may be more safe. The nicotine is still the problem, and that's the same thing with the electronic cigarette. So the idea that the heart attack, stroke rates, other vascular problems aren't increased is just inaccurate.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Thomas. You know, we've talked about this and all of that. Should we go into what the more long-term effects and the things, frankly, that you may not see as part of developing this habit of smoking? Claire, I'll start with you.
Yeah, that caller, most recent caller, was absolutely accurate in the data show for Indiana that 3 out of 10 deaths from cancer result from tobacco, and also 3 out of 10 deaths from heart disease are a direct result of tobacco. And that says that has nothing to do with indirect effects that we've been talking about with exposure to secondhand smoke. So there are multiple negative health impacts related to not only direct exposure to tobacco, but also indirect exposure.
We've gotten a Facebook message from a listener named KJ. And if you want to reach out to us via Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. KJ writes, I live in Carmel. Among more affluent teens, there seems to be a big stigma against those who smoke. At the same time, even good kids, in quotes, are vaping, as if it occurs without consequences. Is this not simply a gateway to nicotine addiction? Without apology, I am rabidly anti-smoking. My mom died 25 years ago at 52 years of age from lung cancer, brought on by smoking that began at age 12 in the 1950s. I think vaping might be worse. You're all looking at each other. One of you has to speak. I'll go with Dr. King.
So definitely vaping is worse. You can get a very high concentration of the nicotine content in your body. And we, for a significant number of people, it is the gateway to more harsher products, such as, I think, marijuana, mm-hmm. The gateway for that. And for some, it may be over time, it may become so addictive, it could possibly lead to more opioid dependence.
The Centers for Disease Control actually just released a report a couple weeks ago, which is a national survey of middle school and high school students. And their report found that more than 7% of middle school students reported some tobacco use, and more than 20% of high school students did. The number one product that those students are using is e-cigarettes. The second is regular cigarettes. There are BDs, hookahs, and then also cigars. So it is definitely true that by experimenting with tobacco, you are more likely to set yourself on a pathway that you might actually become a lifelong addict and a statistic.
We are talking about the impact of smoking on community health here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Marie has done and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Marie writes, "Hello, I think this information on smoking speaks volumes to the lack of opportunity available within social economic status. Lower socioeconomic statuses have a higher frequency of using or abusing substances. We have a statewide opioid crisis because hand-in-hand with using other substances, while smokers and using of other substances costs everyone additional money, we need to look long-term, not just preventing smoking or having people quit, but rather increasing opportunities to avoid the entire issue." And I keep coming back to that first call we had from Ron, where you heard the argument on the other side of that, and to some degree he's responding to what he sees as criticism and a certain amount of moral judgment and all of that. How do we get around that dynamic? Claire?
I'm so glad that you said that, because addiction is a medical problem. It's not a moral issue. If it were easy to quit, we could all do it the first time we tried. If we had a struggle with, be it sugar, fat, tobacco, whatever our addiction might be. And certainly with tobacco, we know that it often takes up to 10 quit attempts before someone can successfully quit. So what we need to do is make sure that we're putting appropriate resources to help people who are addicted get connected with proven programs that will help them quit. That includes medication-assisted treatment, and it also includes the quit line and counseling. So there are a lot of services available. We just need to make sure we connect people with the help that they need.
We have gotten a question from a listener named Barbara who did not want to go on the air. Barbara was an elementary school teacher for 35 years and never saw asthma in her students. She went back to the classroom in the 2000s and saw an average of one asthmatic child in each class. The children came to school smelling of the secondhand smoke of their homes. Not only did smoking impact their health, it impacted their educations and time and interruptions taken to go to the nurse because they were not allowed to keep their inhalers with them. You know, if anything, I mean, we've talked about the impact here of smoking. Have we underplayed? I mean, this, you're talking about something where the effects of this can be generational, where, you know, the fact that a parent decided to smoke can limit a child's opportunities in life and all of that, which, you know, as a parent myself, hits with particular resonance. I'll start with Karen on that one. I mean, does research show that the children of smokers perform at different levels than children of non-smokers? Are they more likely to experience health problems or to struggle in school?
Well, I can.
Oh,
sorry.
Okay, Virginia.
I'll do the doctor bit right now. Okay. What we have found out is that the children of smokers, because of the exposure to secondhand smoke, would trigger a lot of asthmatic attacks. And, you know, in the 8-10 years ago, we kept thinking, wow, the medicine's not working, so I have to give you stronger medicines and medications, when in fact the triggers was the secondhand smoke. And it really impacts your allergies, and it can trigger asthma, and folks who never had asthma before put you at a higher risk for asthma. But like I said, pregnant mothers, you have a young baby inside the home, these babies die unexpectedly, and it's been associated with the SIDS death have been associated with someone smoking in the home. So just so many triggers are related to secondhand smoke.
And maternal smoking is a really big issue in Indiana. We find, and when you look at Indianapolis, in the high-access tobacco areas, maternal smoking is 1.5 times higher than the overall smoking rate in Indiana, and it's 3 times higher than the national smoking rate. So we really do have, children being exposed to tobacco at a very young age before they're even born.
So I want to go back to one of the listeners' questions here about, is there a way to intervene in ways that, because we learned from, I think, the email, the person who sent in the email from Southern Indiana saying, I started 10 years ago, I've been trying to quit, I can't, it's really hard right now. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like the best way to solve this problem is to stop people from smoking in the first place.
Exactly.
Are there rays of hope in this study, Karen, that suggest we are able to make some headway in terms of doing that? Because it sounds like once they start smoking, the task gets much, much more difficult.
Yes, I think that the goal is to prevent smoking in the first place, and I think that's why there's a lot of focus and effort on changing the laws around the smoking age. I think the current desire is to change from 18 to 21. I think the youth are targeted by tobacco marketing, and we really do want to get to them before the tobacco marketers do.
Are there signs that we're able to do that, though? Because, obviously we're down to the portion of the population that it seems to be most resistant to the message that smoking is bad for you. Claire?
I mean, I think you heard from some of our callers that there are a significant number of people who are smoking that would prefer that they weren't smoking, and mm-hmm. they're just really struggling to quit. And you also have seen some surveys where smokers themselves don't want their own children to become smokers. So I think there's an awareness that it would be better not to be addicted to tobacco if at all possible. So I think that I wouldn't agree that there's a resistant population. I think that there are still people that would really like some help quitting. They just need those tools made available to them. That includes policies. It also includes increased public spending to make sure that we have proven prevention programs that are in place all around the state.
And real quickly, because we're getting close on time, we've got about 30 seconds left. We probably, does that across the board mean that the tax on tobacco ought to be increased? Claire, I'll start with you.
A report that we commissioned from the Fairbanks School of Public Health that was released last fall showed unequivocally that the number one policy intervention is to increase the price of cigarettes. That is the best way to prevent people, especially with less income and at a younger age, from starting smoking in the first place, and it encourages current smokers to want to quit.
Well, I think that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Karen Fredrickson-Comer, Claire Fidian-Green, and Dr. Virginia Kane for what is and has been a lively conversation. I'd also like to thank our listeners for some great questions and comments, and as always, for sharing their stories. We're going to be back on Tuesday, Independence Day, when we're going to be talking about packing the parks here in Indianapolis. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.